Well, this does not have the kind of racial uplift ideology that a lot of scholarly projects had earlier in the century. It is conceived in fairly straightforward scholarly terms that there has not been a reliable reference source pulling together this kind of information regarding black people in this country, and we want to provide that.
Literary scholar David Smith for Black History Month 1997. He's here to talk about the new 5-volume encyclopedia of African American culture and history. Welcome to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Later on the program this week, you'll also hear from Harvard University sociologist William Julius Wilson. His new book is entitled When Work Disappears. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products.
As a scholar, I know how difficult it is to do research in this area because of the lack of good resources. And even when you do find resources, so many of them are unreliable. And the thought of being able to put good, reliable information in one place for young people to use in the future is gratifying. It's one of the things that leads us to want to be scholars in the first place.
Literary scholar David Smith. With Jack Salzman and Cornell West, David Smith is a principal editor of the Encyclopedia of African American Culture and History, published last year by Macmillan Library Reference USA. David Smith is a professor of English and dean of the faculty at Williams College. David, give us a sense of the range of topics in the encyclopedia. A to Z, I suppose.
Yes, the whole alphabet and, right. and the whole spread of things. We have articles on political figures and cultural figures. We have a lot of essays that are as much interpretive as factual. There's an article on skin color, for example, which is actually a kind of social history of attitudes about color caste distinction in America. There's an article that Cornell West wrote on black identity, which is really a speculative essay talking about the existential condition of being black in America. So there are interpretive pieces of that sort. There are pieces on things like comic books and marching bands, you know, popular culture topics. There are articles on every state in the Union and many major cities, all kinds of things.
David, tell us about some of the unusual, maybe the unexpected kinds of things that a reader might find leafing through the Encyclopedia of African American Culture and History. Fun stuff, stuff that you wouldn't normally associate with a scholarly project. You, for example, wrote a piece on comedians. Do I have that right?
That's right. I wrote a piece on comedians. It's something that seems like a very obvious topic, but as we got to working on it, we discovered that there was not a scholarly book just on African-American comedians. There were biographies of various individual comedians, mostly written by professional writers who were not necessarily scholars. And I began making calls to people who work on humor, humor studies associations, trying to find somebody to write this article.
Yeah, so you ended up doing it.
Yeah, I ended up doing it after many weeks of making futile phone calls.
Well, give us a sense quickly of who's in this article. Am I, you know, I mean, I don't mean to play favorites, but Eddie Murphy, Richard Pryor, Bill Cosby, that kind of thing. I mean, those are the names that immediately come to mind. Who are the names that wouldn't necessarily jump out?
Well, all of them are there. It goes back into the 19th century a bit and talks about minstrelsy as a kind of backdrop.
And let's not forget Moms Mabley while we're at it.
No, we can't forget Moms Mabley. It talks about people who came out of vaudeville, like Pigmeat Markham and Moms Mabley. It talks about some of the comedians of the 60s, like Slappy White and George Kirby.
Right.
It tries to give a good overview of the various kinds of stand-up comics who have worked in this country from the 20s onwards.
Now, let me ask you to defend this kind of entry, David. I mean, on the one hand, we can make the argument that this Macmillan reference book is very serious and is a work of scholarship. On the other side, somebody listening to this conversation might say, oh, come on, this is pop culture, this is trivializing the subject. How do you respond to that?
It is pop culture. And it's
That's a good thing.
It's a general encyclopedia. It's not just a scholarly or an academic encyclopedia. And you ask yourself, if you're a high school student who's gotten interested in Richard Pryor,
right,
wants to understand the historical context for Richard Pryor, the cultural context, how do you go about doing that?
Mm-hmm.
And in many of these areas, there aren't books. Now, there is a book that was published since we started working on this that Mel Watkins did on the real side, that is a history of black comedians. But in many cases, there just is nowhere for people to go to acquire this information. So the point of the encyclopedia is to provide them a starting point, and there's a bibliography,
mm-hmm,
and it allows someone to get an overview of an area of knowledge and some starters for acquiring more detailed knowledge for themselves.
Fair enough. Now, we've been talking about individuals, by and large, David Smith, in this encyclopedia. How about to press the scholarly button again here? You know, these large sort of historical abstractions, civil rights, progress, freedom, the Civil War. I mean, how do you handle that kind of thing in the context of an encyclopedia, the encyclopedia that you're describing here?
Well, in the case of large topics like that, we turned first to eminent scholars who were well published, highly regarded as authorities on these fields,
right,
on, say, 19th century American history, the Civil War era, and said, would you write for us an essay of 5,000 words on the Civil War?
Mm-hmm. And whatever. Parenthetically, there is not an entry here on Abraham Lincoln, but there are entries on the African Americans who were involved, whose lives and careers are germane to the Civil War. Have I got this right?
That's right. That's right. And the thinking is that there are plenty of articles on Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not denying his importance in African American history, but
right,
it's an encyclopedia on African Americans. And so that was a hard judgment call in some instances, but we feel that it was the right judgment call. There is an article on Uncle Tom's Cabin, but
not Harriet Beecher Stowe.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And if one looks at the importance of the Tom plays in the development of American popular culture in the late 19th century, it seems clear why one needs an article on Uncle Tom's Cabin.
Fair enough. David, what about the argument that encyclopedias such as this should or should not defeat stereotypical thinking? What I'm getting at is this. We may think today of black people in terms of celebrities. We got the Michaels, Michael Jordan and Michael Jackson. We've got Whoopi Goldberg. We've got sports people who make lots of money. Okay, fair enough. This is America. That's what we do. It's a capitalist society. On the other side, you got these stereotypical images of particularly of black males. When we talk about them, we see a lot of stuff in the papers about the criminal class and poverty. We're missing something here, obviously, in the middle. Now, does this encyclopedia address that kind of lack of understanding in our culture, or is that too much to ask of a project of scholarship?
Well, we have a piece that discusses stereotypes, but the mission of the encyclopedia is not a political mission in that sense, or it's not engaged in some kind of symbolic politics. It really is a knowledge project. And insofar as you believe that knowledge is a good bulwark against stereotypes and other forms of bigotry,
mm-hmm,
we hope that the encyclopedia will serve a good purpose. But most immediately, we were concerned with trying to get good articles to get coverage in the areas that we wanted covered, and to make sure that, that everything was accurate.
Mm-hmm. David, here's a footnote to our conversation. Your work as an editor with Professor Saltzman and Professor West in the Encyclopedia of African American Culture and History, you dedicate this project to John Hope Franklin. Why is that important?
It's important on two levels. First of all, on a personal level, John Hope was a teacher to me and to Jack Saltzman. He taught Saltzman at Brooklyn College and taught me at University of Chicago. And so we personally owe him a lot. But more broadly, because John Hope Franklin represents the kind of scholarly integrity and commitment that we hope this project represents. He's the symbol of this enterprise, and it seems appropriate to us to acknowledge his importance as a not just a role model, but as an example of a certain kind of excellence and commitment to scholarly work.
David Smith is a professor of English and dean of the faculty at Williams College. With Jack Saltzman and Cornell West, David Smith is a principal editor of the Encyclopedia of African American Culture and History, published last year by Macmillan Library Reference, USA. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Straight ahead, another conversation for Black History Month 1997. Harvard University sociologist William Julius Wilson is here to talk about his new book, entitled When Work Disappears.
For the first time in the 20th century, most adults in many inner-city ghetto neighborhoods are not working in a typical week. The disappearance of work has adversely affected not only individuals, families, and neighborhoods, but the social life of the city at large as well. Inner-city joblessness is a severe problem that is often overlooked when the focus is mainly placed on poverty and its consequences. The point I want to make is this. Despite increases in the concentration of poverty since 1970, inner cities have always featured high levels of poverty, but the current levels of joblessness in some neighborhoods are unprecedented.
William Julius Wilson teaches at Harvard University. His new book is entitled When Work Disappears. Wilson argues that technological progress and new patterns in the global economy have had terrible effects on the lowest rungs of the American economic ladder. He also argues that despite efforts from both the left and the right to reshape our understanding of welfare and poverty in the American city, the nub of the problem is work, who has it and who gets it. William Julius Wilson's books have been praised by President Bill Clinton, and Time magazine recently selected him as one of the 25 most influential Americans.
Well, the concrete factor is how do we improve the employment base in the inner city neighborhoods? And you have to face reality. Number one, blacks, particularly those who are most disadvantaged, have not benefited from monetary policy and fiscal policy to enhance economic growth. Many of them are outside the labor market and have not been benefited from these policies. Secondly, you have employers, as I talk about in the book, who are not willing to hire inner-city workers when they can hire the immigrants and the women who have entered the labor market in significant numbers in these service sector jobs, which is where a lot of the growth is occurring.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't have a situation where employers are hiring inner-city workers and they're not going to benefit from these policies to enhance economic growth, it seems to me that you're going to have to consider public sector employment of last resort. WPA-style jobs, for example, to get people into the labor market.
Well, now, wait, Bill, let me argue with you. You're making a noble argument, but how in the world are you going to persuade the policymakers, the liberals who are afraid of the conservatives, they don't want to sound too liberal, and you don't want, at the same time, to appease the conservatives, given the arguments that have characterized their political behavior over the last, 10 years or so. Where do you take this argument and find people who are going to be sympathetic?
Well, right now, you have a situation where progressive people are almost intimidated by the rhetoric of contract with America, the contract with America rhetoric. And therefore, they're unwilling to talk about the things that we really have to do to turn things around to move America forward.
It's more of a punishment mentality than it is
What is happening is that the conservatives have defined the terms of the debate,
right,
and we're playing by their rules. And what I argue in the book is that it is time to begin to speak up. It is time to resist the tendency to draw back.
Mm-hmm.
That this is a point where we should be advancing creative, comprehensive programs to address problems that are going to have a severe impact on American society.
Now, where does this process begin? I mean, again, you are a sociologist. You're one man speaking to many people. As a matter of fact, you happen to have the ear of the President of the United States. But that, obviously, by itself is not going to turn the tables.
First of all, I think it's very, very important when you talk about these problems to get the American people to recognize that the inner-city jobless factors problems that I talk about represent a more extreme form of economic marginality and economic dislocation that's sweeping across the nation, that people are experiencing declining real incomes, increasing economic insecurity, many of them experiencing increasing loss of jobs.
So we need to put this on a continuum that
reaches
up to neighborhoods where you don't expect to find these things.
And what we need to do is we need to talk about programs to put America back to work, to decrease economic insecurity. And that's the way we should begin talking about these things, and that instead of pulling back, we should be moving forward with comprehensive, creative programs.
Bill, the word racism has not come up, but it's an ugly word, but let me put it on the table here. Do you look to the nature of human nature when you begin to account for economic and political issues that have a kind of an abstract cast to them rather than, you know, these visceral, heart-rending behaviors that some people will tell us are behind a lot of our inner city problems, that is to say racism itself?
Well, obviously racism continues to be a factor in our society, but it's one among many factors, and I think that sometimes we place so much emphasis on racism that we overlook other factors that are race neutral but that are impacting very adversely on the inner city neighborhoods. And I don't deny the problem of racism, but I think you have to understand the meaning and significance of race in certain situations. For example, we interviewed employers in the greater Chicago area, and it's quite clear that employers do not want to hire inner-city blacks. Now, is that simply racism, or are employers sort of responding to the problems that they see in the inner city, and they're concerned about whether or not inner-city workers are job-ready or have the skills, soft skills, hard skills, that they now require in the labor market.
So how do you answer that question?
Well, I think that for some people, racism is operating. For others, other employers, they are simply saying, look, I have a business to run, and I want the most competent people. And I know that the kids who are growing up in these neighborhoods are at a disadvantage, that they're being crippled in schools, they're being destroyed by their neighborhoods, they're having family problems. I'm sorry about that. I would like to improve that situation, but I have a business to run. And what you see is that the negative responses of employers are not restricted to white employers. Black employers are also highly skeptical and critical, you see. But black employers are a little bit more sophisticated. They recognize some of the social factors behind the problems of work for a lot of the inner city residents, particularly those from the inner city ghetto neighborhoods, that is, the neighborhoods that are most impoverished. And they try to explain these things away. But they still will tell you that there are problems here, you see. And so it seems to me that if we're going to address the problems of employers, we've got to get a situation where they feel comfortable that when a youngster is applying for a job, this person is ready and willing and able to work.
And here we're back to your argument about public sector participation and a sort of general lifting of the attitudes that underscore all of these problems. Bill, let me ask you to talk both as a sociologist and, again, as somebody who is an individual who's passionately involved here. Where do you look when we try to seek models of behavior for young people in the inner cities, men as well as women, and we say to them, this is the way life should be lived, rather than this aimless and drifting, horrible situation that we face in many of these ghetto scenarios. Is that unrealistic to look at individuals and try to model a social behavior on those individuals?
There are a number of programs, I think, that are quite effective, that the mentoring programs, where they bring in successful people, for example, blacks in businesses who come into the inner city neighborhoods and tutor the kids and work with them, their mentors. I think those people are role models that we need to emphasize, if only to sort of give the kids some idea that it is possible, you know, to succeed and to understand what it is that you have to do to succeed.
But these are not the ones who get the press. These aren't the Michaels of the world, Jackson and Jordan. These aren't the sort of superstar athletes and rap artists. These are the people whom, you know, I'm arguing here with you to hear what you've got to say, because a lot of these kids are going to say, so what? I'm not interested in business types or academics or, you know, that form of success. What I want is a different kind of success. How do you respond to that?
Well, it's very, you know, first of all, you're not going to be able to effectively change the orientation of these kids unless they see some real chance for social mobility in society. You can preach all you want, you can hold up all the role models you want, but if these kids do not believe that the doors are going to open for them, they're not going to respond. So what you've got to do, you've got to create situations where kids see that they have a realistic chance of improving their situation, you see. Let me give you an example. I'm involved, one of my next books will deal with this. I'm involved with a program in Chicago that identified kids in a sixth grade in one of the most impoverished schools in the city of Chicago. Took all those kids, 65 kids in the grade, took them all and said, look, if you stay in this program, we will guarantee, if you maintain good grades, we will guarantee a college scholarship for you. And we will also provide you with support. We'll provide you with mentors. We'll work with your parents. And this program has now been in existence for about 6 years. And only a handful of those kids have dropped out of the program, or have gotten involved in gangs, or have gotten pregnant. And this is a school in which a substantial majority of the kids eventually get involved in gangs and drugs pregnancies. Only a handful of kids from this program are now so
involved. What I hear,
and the reason for that is that these kids see that they have an opportunity out there.
There's something at the end of the tunnel.
Right.
Yeah.
And they're very, very optimistic now about their future, and they're not going to jeopardize it.
Well, what you're arguing, Bill, is you know, the notion that all politics is local. Can we generalize from this? I mean, do you, in fact, take some encouragement, and do I hear some optimism here in this situation that you're describing about solving these,
look, I think,
what appear to be intractable problems?
For me, you know, if you allow pessimism to take over, you throw up your hands in despair and you do nothing. Now, I fight pessimism all the time. I've got to be optimistic. I've got to believe that eventually we will come to grips with these problems.
Mm-hmm.
I've talked with a lot of people in powerful places who are very, very concerned. And what I'm hoping is that we can increase even more concern among Americans of different walks of life and different power positions, different experiences. I just, you know, I I believe that people are concerned about the problems and want to do something about them. A lot of them don't understand the nature of the problem. And I think scholars like myself have a moral obligation. Scholars who are writing about these problems have a moral obligation not only to speak to people in our profession,
right,
but make sure the message reaches a broad audience. Make sure that it reaches politicians, policymakers, the media, and the average person.
William Julius Wilson is a professor of social policy in the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. His new book is entitled When Work Disappears, available from Knopf. His other books include The Declining Significance of Race and The Truly Disadvantaged. You're listening to Soundings, a radio magazine about books and ideas from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings is made possible by funding from TIAA CREF, providing financial services exclusively for people employed in education and research, offering pension, tax-deferred investment, and insurance products. I'll be back in just a moment with information about where to write for an audio tape of this program. You're listening to Soundings from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. My guests this week were David Smith of Williams College and William Julius Wilson of Harvard University. For an audio tape, call us at 919-549-0661 or send $10 to Soundings, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. Our zip code is 27709. This week, it's program number 854. Visit our site on the World Wide Web at nhc.rtp.nc.us/8080. Next week, Archiving the Internet. Join me for another segment in our continuing series on the history of information technology. In collaboration with the Computer World Smithsonian Awards Program, Soundings will feature a conversation with cyberspace pioneer Brewster Kahle, founder of the Internet Archive in San Francisco, California. Finally this week, a program note. A few cabins remain on the National Humanities Center study session to the Greek islands and Turkey aboard the exclusively chartered four-masted yacht Sea Cloud. Information provided at 1-888-650-TOUR. That's 1-888-650-8687. Until next week's show, thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Soundings is a weekly cultural affairs radio service of the National Humanities Center.